Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Hey, everybody. We've got a gruesome one today for a change. Brian Fogel, the producer of The Dissident, a documentary about Jamal Khashoggi's life, his admirable life, and grisly death, will provide some insight into why Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of this brilliant, principled, and courageous journalist. I don't know if you'll enjoy this conversation, but it's an important one, I think. The Saudis are bitter enemies of Iran, and I suppose the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but this is a case where the enemy of my enemy is a brutal, sadistic dictator. Before we go to the interview, I just want to remind you all that I'll be on a 15-city tour starting September 18th in North Haven, Mass. And you can check alfranken.com for all the dates and to get tickets. I hope to see you somewhere around the country there. We're going pretty much all over the place. So now for my conversation with Brian Fogel, a harrowing one for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I wouldn't say I enjoyed the documentary. It was kind of harrowing, but a lot of people do enjoy that kind of thing. I mean, it's really about Khashoggi's journey from being he was an insider with the Saudi family, right? The royal family.
Well, his last name is Khashoggi, and the roots of the family was from Turkey, and so sadly, as Jamal was being murdered, his killers were essentially taunting him that he was a mutt, that he actually wasn't Saudi, but his family certainly was prominent in the kingdom for a long time, and he was considered an insider. He did work for the royal family for the majority of his career, essentially as a journalist liaison, where he would help kind of navigate Saudi policy and help, you know, the kingdom in, you know, its goals abroad. And then a lot of that also was his writing and his journalism, which until Mohammed bin Salman, he essentially had kind of the freedom to critique and, you know, maybe not press freedom like we think we have in the United States or in most of Western Europe, but he did have the ability to say, hey, I don't quite sure if this policy is good for our country or so on and so forth.
But he was kind of an insider. In other words, as a journalist, he had access. And until bin Salman, the crown prince, now the crown prince, took power, his father named him crown prince. Is that it?
Yes. I mean, look, he was an insider in that he really knew how the royal family worked. He knew, you could argue that he knew the majority of the, you know, of the major, you know, the brothers. And
It's a big family.
Yeah, the princes, huge family. The princes and those in power, you know, there's multiple photographs of Jamal. Whether that's Jamal sitting alongside of Obama, or whether that's, you know, Jamal with Mohammed bin Salman, or King Salman, or his predecessor.
I want people to understand, I want our listeners to understand what a sacrifice he was making. And he was making it because when bin Salman came in, people thought he was a reformer. I remember he did something so women could drive, right? And everyone was very excited about that. We have a reformer there, but that wasn't the case, right? And that eventually is what forced Khashoggi's decision to leave and go to the United States. But he left a family behind. Is that right?
Well, he had, you know, his children were grown. You know, he had, you know, four children, two sons, two daughters. One son was living in the kingdom. And the other three at the time of his murder were living in the United States. At least his two daughters were, you know, but he left his wife, and he and his wife, you know, according to his friends and those that I've spoke to, were, you know, that they had a very good marriage. He was close to his wife. And when he went into self-exile, essentially she was brought in by Saudi, you know, whatever you want to call it, secret police, and basically interrogated and told that she was going to call her husband and demand a divorce because, you know, in Saudi Arabia, only the man can grant a woman a divorce.
Now, and this is a reformer. Okay, this is bin Salman. So he wasn't a reformer, as it turns out. And that's why, when does bin Salman become the crown prince and pretty much the de facto ruler of the country? What year is
he was appointed crown prince on the 21st of June, 2017.
Oh, wow. So this happened fast. And Khashoggi starts to write critical stuff and then decides, I better get out of here at a certain point. Comes to Washington, becomes a op-ed writer for the Washington Post, and is writing critical stuff about the Saudi government.
Well, a little more complicated than that. He had MBS becomes crown prince, and as you said, Al, I mean, here is this guy who's being touted around the world. You might have remembered his big tour of the United States. I believe this was in March or April of 2018, where he went and met with Jeff Bezos and Obama and Larry Ellison and Bill Gates and former President Bush and Elon Musk.
He just needed to talk to billionaires, basically. Yeah.
And he did a big billionaire tour of the United States.
Because he only really wants to talk to billionaires. Being, how much is he worth, bin Salman?
My guess would be that he's a trillionaire.
Okay. All right.
Because
that's a thousand billion.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is that Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, Larry Ellison, Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, maybe if you combine them all together, you get MBS. But who really knows? Because the family, the House of Saud, and he essentially controls the wealth of that entire kingdom, and also they're minting money at the oil pump. And also the liquidity.
They have oil?
Investments. So.
Wait a minute. That's a big part of the story. I didn't realize that. The Saudis have oil?
Apparently they have a little bit.
He was going to be a reformer. Turns out not to be a reformer. Khashoggi starts writing critically. He starts to get the sense that he might be put in prison. Goes to the United States, writes for the Washington Post, and in the Washington Post, he's writing critically of the Saudis government. He is in extreme disfavor. And in your movie, you kind of focus also on a number of other dissidents. One in Toronto, was he?
That's in Montreal, Omar Abdulaziz.
This young man feels that any minute he could be killed by Saudi government. This is incredibly disturbing, and obviously it goes to the murder of Khashoggi. Now, I want to ask you about that, and it's very graphic, the film, in terms of you have audio that was from the Turkish embassy. He was killed, the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, was it?
That's correct.
Yeah, and he goes in. He has been divorced. He has a fiance who's Turkish, and he needs to get some document, right, from the Saudis.
Basically, he's got to get even though he was divorced under Turkish law, if a man's been married, he needs to prove that he's divorced to be remarried. So he was seeking paperwork, from Saudi Arabia to prove that he was in fact divorced, so that he could marry Hatice.
So he goes there, and she's waits outside, and he goes in, and we have the video of him going in, and he doesn't emerge.
Correct.
The part of this story that my listeners probably know is this part, which is he's murdered. There's tape of this, right? Or at least the transcript. And he's basically saying, you're going to kill me.
Yeah. In the film, I worked with the Republic of Turkey, their investigators and intelligence, and ultimately, the blessing of the president's office. And they
good man, good man, Erdogan. Good man. You can't say anything bad about him. He helped your film, so don't say anything bad about Erdogan.
Exactly.
I'll do that in the intro and then at the end. Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that
when you're gone.
I'll just bite my tongue.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, the Turks over a year time cooperated and helped and participated and allowed interviews and access that, even right now in this film, I mean, not CNN, not BBC, no news agency in the world got that sort of evidence and access outside of perhaps, intelligence agencies like the CIA or MI6, but I was able to obtain the full transcript.
That's right.
We were offered the audio, but declined it because it just felt gratuitous.
Wow. That's interesting. That's interesting. So you've listened to the audio?
I did not.
Okay.
About a year into it, around the time that I received the transcript, which was right on the one-year anniversary of Jamal's murder, when Jeff Bezos came to Istanbul with Fred Ryan, many of Jamal's friends to speak, they had offered me to listen to the audio, pull some segments from the audio and the transcript. And at that point, I'd been deeply involved in the story for a year. I didn't need to hear that.
That's an interesting choice for a filmmaker, because of course, people who like that kind of thing, they'd like that kind of thing. but that was an admirable choice you made.
Well, the choice really became at that point. I had been, working for a year with Hatice Cengiz, his fiance Omar, the Saudi dissident in Montreal, and in a circle of Jamal's very close friends. And
so
the idea for me that I would put that audio into the film, regardless of the gratuitous nature of it, but that these people that loved him and cared for him would then have to hear that. Obviously, we know what happened. There's been multiple intelligence reports, and in dealing with the UN, the United Nations Special Rapporteur.
That's Agnes Callamard. Is that her
name? Agnes Callamard. She's now she's just been named the head of Amnesty International.
And she has accused the Saudis of threatening her.
That is correct. There was a story in The Guardian just a week ago.
And that's the Saudi Arabia's Human Rights Commission threatened her. And she was doing the investigation for the UN. And she's concluded that bin Salman ordered this. Am I right?
That is correct. And Joe Biden released the CIA's intelligence findings. And the CIA concluded the same thing, that it was essentially impossible that a murder of this nature that was orchestrated using state resources, private jets owned by the Crown Prince, Crown Prince's security detail, on and on and on, could have ever happened without the direct consent and involvement of the Crown Prince.
Let's talk about exactly what happened inside that embassy. What's on the transcript? Why don't you run that down? I'll let you do that.
Well, Jamal, enters the consulate. This was October 2nd, 2018. This was his third trip in total to a consulate to try to get these marriage papers. The first time he went in Washington, D.C., as I mentioned, he was owned a home there, was splitting his time between Washington and Istanbul. And he goes in and meets with the Crown Prince's brother, who at the time was the ambassador to the United States from Saudi Arabia. He's greeted warmly and doesn't feel like there's any problems. And he's told, we'll help you with this, Jamal, no problem, but you need to go to Istanbul to get this done. So he goes to Istanbul, to see Hatice. He walks into the consulate there. They had already been expecting him. And again, they tell him, hey, no problem. But can you come back in a week? We need time to get the paperwork ready. So again, Jamal leaves the consulate, believing that nothing's wrong, and comes back October 2nd of 2018 to pick up the paperwork. And on that day, there was essentially a 15-man kill team waiting for him inside that consulate. They bring him up to media room in the consulate, which was upstairs next to the director general's office. And if you know the layout of the consulate, this is kind of an odd choice, because if you're going to get documentation or whatever, that would still be on the first floor. And this media room, which looks like a conference room, was the only room in the consulate where they could make a secure encrypted phone call or video call to Riyadh, back to the kingdom. So they bring him up to this media room, and within about 2 minutes of him entering that consulate, maybe 3 minutes at most, he is being murdered. And just a horrific, incredibly awful, brutal murder. They're literally injecting him with embalming agents as they're strangling him.
Jesus, I thought they were injecting him with some kind of, something that put him to sleep or something. No? Embalming fluid?
Apparently there was some of that too. But, right after he died.
They suffocate him, right?
They suffocate him. They put a bag over his head. And they suffocate him, and it's a real struggle. And as they're suffocating him, apparently they are also injecting him with blood coagulants because the plan is to immediately cut him up. And if his heart's still beating, you know, the coagulants will spread through his body quicker. So, you know, he just meets a horrific death right after they murder him. They dismember his body with a bone saw into pieces.
Horrific. Now, of course, he doesn't leave the building, except they actually put plastic down and package his body. We'll talk about how they dispose of the body, but they lie right away, of course, saying that he left, right? And eventually they say, he died in a fight or something. And eventually they, he was murdered, but the crown prince didn't order this, and they have a trial, and I guess it's a show trial, and some of them are convicted. Am I saying that
kind
right?
Of, yeah. I mean, they, you know, the long and short of it is they deny over the next 2 weeks that anything had happened to Jamal. And essentially what the world comes to learn during this time, because of Turkey's investigation and because of, you know, the audio and all the closed captioned security surveillance footage that they were able to put together all over Istanbul, Turkey was able to paint an open and closed case. They had the surveillance footage of his kill team entering in through, you know, airport security, a lot of it at a private airport. They had all the audio of his murder from the media room, and they essentially went back to Saudi Arabia and said, hey guys, you're going to confess, or we're going to confess for you. And Saudi Arabia said, yeah, whatever, you don't have anything. And a Saudi delegation came to Istanbul and they played them the audio. They showed them the surveillance footage and they said, okay, you're going to confess. And Saudi Arabia finally confessed, albeit the story was never to this day that it was a intentional operation and that they planned to kill him. The story is still that they had hoped that he was going to come back. And when he refused to come back, one guy made a decision and he shouldn't have made that decision. And they weren't planning to kill him, but they killed him and dismembered him and carried
through. Well, there is on the audio someone saying the sacrificial animal has arrived.
That's correct.
I mean, we know there was an intention to kill him, but they say there wasn't before he arrived.
I think what Saudi Arabia's game has been, you know, which is, you know, you get this the same thing out of Putin or, you know, or any one of these places. I mean, not really that shocking or surprising. I mean, I think their game has been, you know, to just go, it was an accident.
Yeah, that's why you have the bone saw ready and the plastic bags. Yeah.
Right. Because you just might accidentally kill and dismember someone.
Yeah, that's suspicious.
A little bit. But, you know, I guess you can make the argument that the bone saw was there just in case.
Well, just in case they had
just in case you need
a sacrificial animal come in. Yeah. Let's talk about what he was writing about while he was writing for the Post. He was critical of the regime, obviously. That's why they killed him. He was critical about the war in Yemen.
Yes. I mean, when you go back, and this was one of the major reasons why I wanted to make The Dissident, that I wanted to make this film. I had come out of doing Icarus, my previous film, which had exposed Russia's state-sponsored doping operation. It was a decades-long scandal that cheated basically every athlete in the world who competed against Russia out of medals and prizes. And I was trying to figure out what that next story was going to be. And here the murder of Jamal happens. And as I'm reading it, you know, you have a journalist, a Washington Post journalist, who was advocating for human rights in his country, freedom of press, freedom of speech, supportive of the crown of a royal family of the kingdom, but also coming from a Western perspective, a guy who had been spending his life back and forth to the West, believing that there could be a better way, that you didn't need to have a authoritarian, autocratic dictatorship where you're repressing every freedom to rule a country well. And so as Crown Prince, you know, Mohammed bin Salman rises to power, on one hand, he's making reforms that to the Western world look like it's positive, granting women the right to drive, for example. And on the other hand, he's basically making it that anybody, and I mean anybody, who has an opinion against him or doesn't share a positive opinion about him is being arrested, thrown in jail, put on mock trials, tortured, beheaded. And when I say not in support of him, they basically went around and anybody who was famous or well known in Saudi Arabia, if they didn't take to their social media platforms or their outlets supporting Mohammed bin Salman, they would find themselves, you know, interrogated and arrested and said, hey, here's what you need to do. So silence was not enough. You had to be, you know, verbally writing, whatever, communicating your support for the Crown Prince. Khashoggi decides that he's not going to do this. He goes to Washington. And what he's basically writing about, if you go back into his Washington Post columns and read what he was writing about that year, is that he believed that the U.S.-Saudi relationship, especially with Donald Trump, was not a healthy relationship. So he was critical of Donald Trump. He believed that Mohammed bin Salman was essentially milking the country for its resources, and that there needed to be a larger trickle down of wealth. He believed that women should have rights in the country. And he believed that people should be able to express their opinion without the fear of being locked up and thrown into jail. These are all things that I think all of us in the United States or in the West take for granted. The idea that we can, you know, whatever, say,
of course.
I don't like Joe Biden, and that doesn't mean you're going to be arrested, thrown into a jail, and sit without charges. And so this was what Jamal was writing about. And at the same time, Jamal comes to understand the power of social media, of Twitter. And I think we think of Twitter as a platform to go on and share an idea or share a rant or disseminate false information or whatever you want to call it. But we don't view it as a platform for control, for actual taking control. And what the Saudis learned during the Arab Spring is that the Arab Spring happened because of Twitter. Millions and millions, tens of millions of people around that region were able to take onto Twitter, create false accounts, and find ways to revolt and organize. And so they started to understand the power of that platform. And in a country like Saudi Arabia, where you have an authoritarian state, where people are not able to communicate freely, 8 out of 10 people in Saudi Arabia are using Twitter, because Twitter became essentially the parliament of the country, because you can go on there and create accounts under different names and share ideas and thoughts anonymously. And Jamal's Twitter, and he's got 2 million followers at the time, is being suppressed every single time he puts out a tweet. All of a sudden, you have thousands of comments on his Twitter feed that he's a traitor, that he should, you know, that he's the scum of the earth, that his country hates him. And what he learns is that these tweets against him and comments are not real, that it's actually the Saudi government that has hired thousands of people to sit into rooms to create false tweets and narratives on Twitter that basically makes Mohammed bin Salman rise to the top and look like he's, you know, perfect, while suppressing any other opinion against him on Twitter. And so Jamal and Omar Abdulaziz start working on a plan called the Bees Army to combat the Saudi flies on Twitter. And they hack Omar's phone using Israeli cybersecurity software that the Saudis do. They hack Jamal's phone using the same Israeli cybersecurity Pegasus software. And it's arguably this reason and what he was writing in the Washington Post, the understanding that he was helping to fund an operation to reclaim freedom of speech in Saudi Arabia on Twitter and social media, on top of his writings in a Western newspaper that were not supportive of Mohammed bin Salman and Trump. I think these two key factors led to his murder.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Brian Fogel, producer of The Dissident, a film about the life and murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, let's talk about the calculus of U.S. foreign policy, Trump versus Biden. We obviously understand that Trump didn't do anything and just wanted to continue arms sales. That's actually what Trump said, right? It was, we get billions in arms sales to them. I'm not going to rock any boats.
Correct.
That doesn't sound like Joe Biden. What is your take on his calculus in terms of not being more punitive toward the Crown Prince and toward Saudi Arabia?
You know, it's interesting. As Biden came to office, and someone like myself, who had obviously been following this story, you know, so closely, there was a real, I guess, hope. You can call it hope. There was a real belief, because Biden also campaigned and has spoken publicly so many times on, you know, if I'm president, I plan to reassess the U.S.-Saudi relationship on the anniversary of Jamal's second anniversary of Jamal's murder back in October of 2020. You know, he even sent out a statement with the hashtag Justice for Jamal. So, you know, he was part of his platform was, I'm going to reassess the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And he releases this report that lays out the CIA report lays out saying that Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And at the same time, he declines to take any sanctions, any actions, any punishment while seeking the punishment for the kill team, the guys working for him. And so I think what you have, I mean, just in a very, you know, cut and dry, easy understanding of politics, is that Biden made a decision that to actually punish or impose sanctions was not probably in the best business interests of the U.S. And declined to do so.
There also might be geopolitical calculus at play here, just in terms of the Saudis are the enemy of Iran. And the enemy of our enemy is our friend, which brings us to Yemen and the travesty there. You know, I led an effort early on that with an odd coalition, Rand Paul and Chris Murphy and I to stop arms sales to the Saudis for the weapons that they were using in Yemen. That was not successful. It did finally pass later, but it was vetoed by Trump. But that is just a humanitarian travesty and disaster. And that, again, is very much about the Iran-Saudi, their rivalry, shall we say, in the region. It's, this is a very, very complicated geopolitical question, but it's kind of heartbreaking.
I think where Biden has been effective, at least right now, or what I'm hearing, is in curtailing the war in Yemen. You know, he did veto the last $500 million worth of weapon sales that Trump tried to pass through on his way out. You know, I guess the talks in Washington is that, you know, there is no more support for the war in Yemen. And I think probably part of his negotiating tactics of not issuing sanctions or going after the crown prince and the murder of Khashoggi was probably, who knows, but probably some sort of backdoor agreement, you know, regarding the war in Yemen. When you talk about the political nature of this, if you've followed any of the kind of human rights abuse stories in Saudi Arabia, about 4 years ago, they arrested a female activist. Her name is Loujain Al-Hatoul. Loujain at the time was, I believe, 28 years old, came from a pretty, well thought of upper class Saudi family, and started to write and take to the streets for women's rights in the country, that women should have a right to vote, that women should not be under the guardian system. Which in Saudi Arabia, no woman can leave the home alone by herself without the permission of an 18-year-old male guardian in the home. So literally, once your son becomes 18 years old, he has the permission to decide whether his mother can leave the house.
I mean, and is it, this is enforced?
I don't know the details, but apparently there's like an app on the phone and there's like a letter. And that, you know, a woman, if she's stopped, needs to basically show that she has been granted permission by a male over the age of 18 in her house to be out and about.
Boy, that is so Taliban, isn't it?
Yes, it's nutty. So, yeah. You know, so Loujain is writing against this, and she's arrested. And she sits in a jail for 3 years, basically. You know, with all these, you can read millions of things of her on the internet, you know, with all these false charges. And they then put her on trial last year, and they convict her. And she's supposed to spend another 6 years in prison because she had served three of her term. So she's going to spend another 6 years in prison. And then about a week, 2 weeks before Biden releases the intelligence report, Saudi Arabia suddenly releases Loujain Al-Hatoul. So clearly this was an olive branch to the Biden administration. And clearly there was some sort of whatever was going on that they released Loujain, because a month earlier they had sentenced her to another 6 years.
Man, oh man. I think there's stuff we don't know, but at least so she was released and we don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes, I suspect.
Well, look, I mean, you're obviously, you're yours in politics. It felt like to me in the time that I spent, you know, and I went to Washington with Hatija, Jamal's fiance, and we met with a number of senators and congressmen and even Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff and Mark Warner. And
chairs of the intelligence committees.
That's correct. And everybody, you know, on the surface was like, this is awful. We got to do something about it. We have to, you know, really do something about it. But somewhere along the we have to do something about it and actually doing something about it, I think a lot of politics and defense and, you know, and allies in the region, this, that, and the other step in the way of taking responsibility for human rights abuses such as this horrific murder or such as, you know, what's going on to countless others in the kingdom.
Yeah, well, and again, that's the geopolitics of this. There's a moment in the movie that I want to ask you about, which is there's some convening of some hearing about all this, and his fiance testifies, and she's about to speak, and the Saudi officials leave.
That's right. She was...
That just was appalling.
Yeah, so Agnes Callamard, who was the UN, the United Nations Special Rapporteur, to investigate the murder. Once she was done with her report, goes to testify in front of the United Nations Human Rights Council. And for those of your listeners who may or not know this, not only did the United States withdraw itself under Trump from the United Nations Human Rights Committee, which was kind of unreal to be there and see that the United States, its desk was empty. Saudi Arabia sits on this committee. And so Agnes goes to deliver her report to the committee on the murder of Jamal. After she does, Hatice Cengiz, Jamal's fiance, speaks, asking for justice. And as she's speaking, the two Saudi delegates literally stand up, pack their bags, and leave the room. One of the most rudest, you know, jaw-dropping moments I've ever seen as a filmmaker, somebody, you know, as a documentarian, to see this, you know, complete disrespect in this situation. But also to understand that the United Nations at that level in their Human Rights Committee basically has no power to do anything. Their role is basically to observe and report. And after Agnes Callamard's findings, that's a very, very thorough investigation, the Secretary General and the Security Council and all that of the UN that could have done something all declined to take any action because it wasn't in the best interests of the G20. You know, so understanding that the United Nations and even that scene that you see in the film where, you know, this scathing report is delivered and the Saudis stand up and walk out of the room as Hatice is speaking, was largely ceremonial. There wasn't really any action that was going to be taken or could be taken. And the UN, you know, General Assembly and Security Council declined to take up the investigation.
But that moment in the film is really heartbreaking because they walk out on the fiance of this guy who, whether or not they admit that the Crown Prince ordered this or not, the lack of respect was jaw-dropping, as you say, and heartbreaking and disgusting.
And being with Hatice during that time where I spent the greater part of a year with her, traveling all over the world as she spoke to European Parliament, as she spoke in the UK, as she spoke in the UN, as she went to Washington. And, you know, it was heartbreaking to see a murder so cut and dry, to see something of this horrific nature and realize that money and power allows you to get away with crimes such as this and in the world that we're living in.
One thing I want to say about the film that I really want to emphasize to the audience, to our listeners, is that you get a sense of this guy, of Khashoggi, and you get a sense of a terrific guy and a guy with a lovely man and a guy with a brilliant man and a guy with a sense of humor and a guy who the most admirable kind of guy, but someone who clearly was like a good friend and clearly a guy that people really who knew him really liked, a real stand-up guy. I mean, of course, you're a stand-up guy to leave your country to be a dissident. But, I mean, I'm talking about the footage you have of him where you see him just talking with folks, with friends. He just seemed like a lovely, lovely man.
I didn't get to meet Jamal. And one of the main determining factors of whether or not I was going to go spend the next, you know, 2+ years of my life, you know, dedicated to making this film and its subsequent promotion, et cetera, was, did I feel that I would have liked Jamal?
Mm-hmm.
And
I could understand
everywhere
that,
I came across, the answer was yes. And, you know, and they say that you know, a man is known by the friends he keeps. And certainly each person that I met along this journey that knew Jamal, that had worked with Jamal, that was friends with Jamal, not only did they have a love for him, I liked them. And so I went, wait, his circle of friends is all people that I would find myself wanting to be friends with or find myself wanting to have an interesting conversation with, or who were intellectually evolved, who were outside of the norm of what you might think of for someone in that region or philosophically, et cetera. And certainly, not only did I find that over and over again, it was across the board. And then as I read Jamal's writings, I said to myself, this is someone I would have liked. I could have seen myself being friends with.
Well, someone you'd really be honored to be a friend with, because his integrity, his courage. I mean, the sacrifice he made, and also the commitment to his principles and to democracy and to his country. Pretty amazing guy. Well, thank you so much, Brian, and congratulations on the film. I recommend it to anyone. It's not funny, I will say that.
No, but you know, we for those of your listeners that might have seen Icarus, the dissident, we really crafted it to hopefully feel like a scripted feature thriller, like a big Bourne Identity-esque thriller, except it's all true.
There is definitely that feeling in the film. It feels like exactly that. It is a thriller, but I guess we gave away the ending. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Al.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.